Hey, this is Sarah.
And I'm Trish. Welcome to Trying to Win.
This is our podcast about being civil trial lawyers and our practice, both inside and outside the courtroom. Lessons to learn on all of it.
That's right.
In this episode, we're going to talk about some of our toughest cases ever. So it should be lessons learned from
battle.
Definitely
battle scars,
battle wounds. In some instances, sometimes circumstances that arose that were completely unexpected. Sometimes just how to manage a really tough witness. All of that will be wrapped up in this episode.
Tough witness and tough lawyers on the other side. Sometimes tough judges, actually.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that make a case hard. It may be that it's really hard because of the facts that you have. It might be really hard because of who opposing counsel is. And it can be really hard sometimes because there's a really good witness against you in a case. So there's a lot of different ways to describe what your toughest case is. So these will be just a few. I'm sure we've had many.
They all feel like they're pretty tough to me, but well, yeah. I'm still looking for that easy one.
Haven't had an easy one that I'm aware of. But some are just
tougher than others.
So do you want to go first?
Me go first. Sure. Gosh, mine was probably about 6 years ago. And in my case, I think the thing that made it so difficult, so let me go back a minute, because you and I have had a lot of trial experience because of the way we sort of quote unquote grew up, right? Doing all the district court cases, starting with the small, I used to call them wreck and neck cases, but the chiropractor cases, the rear enders, and just trying them back to back to back to back. And so, you know, I feel like that really positioned us for good success in the courtroom for future tough cases, the bigger cases. Yeah. And it gave us a lot of tools that maybe some of the lawyers who came from the larger, more traditional law firms where there was more at stake and the cases were bigger, and you couldn't throw a first-year associate in a trial situation. So we really kind of, I don't know, I like to consider ourselves to be somewhat street fighters. Like, we learned the hard way. We learned by growing up in the courtroom, making the mistakes that we've talked about on here. You know, seeing what other lawyers do, seeing what works and what doesn't work, and, you know, getting yelled at. I mean, the bailiff coming and telling you, you know, hey, don't do this or whatever. So we really had that advantage. And in this particular case, for me, I came up against a lawyer on the other side who grew up the same way. And he was a street fighter. And I mean a street fighter. Just a natural cross-examiner, very aggressive, super street smart. And also a little unethical, I have to say. And the combination of someone who has those street skills in conjunction with somebody who's willing to push the envelope ethically and factually is really a dangerous combination. And it's not something that you automatically expect. And it's not something I had encountered quite in this way before, but it really made for a tough case. And
it's certainly not something that they teach you about in law school.
No.
That there are going to be people like that out there that might push the envelope on you and might do some things that might raise some eyebrows if you're a law professor, but is something that happens in courtrooms around the country every day.
Yes. I mean, I think that there are lawyers that are, what do you say, fast and loose with the facts. And when you have someone like that on the other side with the experience and the tenacity and the aggression all mixed in one, it's a very dangerous combination, because I not only am trying to tell my story of my case and the narrative, you know, that we want the jury to hear, but I'm also having to watch over my shoulder all of the moves that the, you know, my opposing counsel is making. So in this particular case, I'll give you one story just to give it a good example. So this was a medical malpractice case, and I had a witness on the stand, a very, very distinguished, who's an expert, and I was representing the physician, and there was an injured plaintiff on the other side claiming that the physician had caused him to have very serious injuries. Anyway, so I had an expert witness who was going to testify and support my physicians and explain the care that they gave and et cetera and what happened. And this guy was from an Ivy League university, had a CV 200 pages long, had written everything about everything. I mean, he was wonderful, wonderful, and very great expert, just had tons of credentials and clout.
And presented really well.
In fact, I had him on direct. We did our, you know, PowerPoints and showed videos and, you know, pictures and explained everything. And the jury was nodding, and I felt so good about the way things were going. And so the lawyer on the other side gets him to cross-examine him, and he says, "Isn't it true, doctor, that one third of your income comes from testifying for doctors. And I'm objection. I don't even know why I'm objecting because I don't know where he's going with this, but I know it doesn't sound good, right?
And that's always a good reason to object. You might get lucky.
Sometimes you just have to do that, right? He says, no, that's not the case. And the lawyer says, doctor, I'm going to ask you again. Isn't it true that one third of your income comes from doing things like this, representing doctors, getting paid for representing doctors? Doctor on the witness stand says, absolutely not. Well, now, doctor, you've testified before under oath that one third of your income comes from doing what you're doing today. You make 33% of a living doing what you're doing right now, don't you? He says, I have no idea what you're talking about. Of course, he whips out a piece of paper, you know, gets the whole thing out and whips out the piece of paper and walks up to the witness to impeach him. Do you remember testifying in XYZ case? Yeah, I remember that. And I'm going to show you this. Is this your name on the transcript? Yes, that's it. That's me. I'm going to read you what it says, and I want you to read your answer. Question, doctor, how much of your income comes from representing or serving as an expert witness on behalf of physicians and hospitals? Read your answer, doctor. One third, right? So now I've built up this person. He looks, he'd given this great story. The jury was nodding with us. And in just 5 minutes, his credibility has been completely destroyed. He looks like a hired gun. And it was awful. And I was objecting and asking to see. So the lawyer on the other side hands me the piece of paper, right? The transcript. Gives it to me. Sure enough, it's my doctor. It's a page in a deposition. And I'm saying, I want the whole deposition. I want the whole deposition.
Or at least the page before
like,
that one.
I need to see what this says, right? Because, I mean, right. my doctor, I know he didn't. I know he doesn't do this very often. I mean,
he doesn't lie.
He barely agreed to do it for me, right? I mean, I had to beg him. So anyway, needless to say, he won't do it again. But anyway, I finally, after the lunch break, I said, I want the whole thing. The judge finally said, he's like, the lawyer says, I don't have it with me. I only have this one page, of course, right? So finally, the judge says over lunch, go get the rest of it and give it to her. And lo and behold, guess you would not believe what he did. The page before that said, of the income you derive from being an expert witness, how much of it comes from representing doctors and hospitals? One third. So it wasn't one third of his annual income. It was one third of the money that he makes
serving as
an expert. Right. And mm-hmm. guess where the other two thirds came from? Representing
plaintiffs.
Patients. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So he'd taken something that actually made my guy look more credible and more honest because he rarely does this. And when he does, 66% of the time, he does it for the patient against the doctors and made it this whole different scenario. So context is everything, you know? And I guess
context and perspective.
Yeah. And he pulled that a few times during trial. And the lesson I came away with after all of that, I mean, he had some other hoodoos. The lesson was don't ever trust what the other person is saying. Always double check, get the whole truth, right? The truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And make sure that you've got that so that you can be prepared in the event you come across somebody like that. Now, I'm not going to say that it was intentional. I'm not going to say it was intentional.
We're not going to say it was intentional.
I hope it was not, but you have to be on the lookout for those kinds of things all the time. So I think, the lesson is don't trust anybody. And I hate to say that. It's a sad comment on our legal system, but you will encounter people like that. Now, I've also had trials against one very recently where we didn't even need a judge in the courtroom. I mean, we both conducted ourselves perfectly professionally and nobody colored outside the lines. But when you find that person who colors outside the lines, you got two jobs to do. Represent your client and watch every move that they make.
Yeah, well, and I think the lesson that you learned for you was, A, stick to your guns and make sure that when you want to see the whole sheet of paper, you see the whole sheet of paper, right? But also, the lesson from his perspective, if he learned anything from that, was your credibility as the lawyer matters in front of a jury.
Oh, yeah.
And
matters in front of everybody.
Well, it should, yes.
It should.
You know, I mean, if we're here talking about trying cases, your credibility both with the jury and with the judge matters. And he ended up losing that case and had asked the jury for a substantial sum of money.
There were some zeros.
And, you know, if he had not pulled that trick, who knows if the outcome may have been different, because he had a relatively, you know, sympathetic plaintiff in terms of how damaged he was. And so, you know, if you're going to try and cross examine somebody with what might be a quote unquote
questionable
trick, right? A trick where you're really pushing the envelope.
What do you say, Sarah? It's not clean. It's got to be clean. If you're going to cross examine somebody, it needs to be a clean shot. Clean also means fair because, yes. You know, you and you're right. And I think the credibility thing that you just mentioned, we were in the car earlier talking today, and your credibility got you out of a really rough situation potentially because of your professional reputation. I remember when I first started practicing, one of the senior partners who I just near and dear to me, wonderful lawyer, he said to me, you know, the first day of your reputation is today. What do you want it to look like?
Mm-hmm.
Because you know, while judges and are very objective and, you know, we expect that obviously, you know, there's got to be a question of the benefit of the doubt. And if you've always been honest, the expectation is you'll continue to be. And if you've never been honest, the expectation is we all have to watch you. And it's not a place that you want to be.
Absolutely not.
It's not justice. It's not, you know, when you're saying clean shots, that's fair. That's what it's supposed to be, not games. And you had a situation, I know you were talking about your tough case, where there was a little monkey business, I guess, and you were able to survive.
I'm not sure how much monkey business there was, but there was definitely there was an expert against me in a case involving an endoscopic procedure where my doctor did a biopsy using direct visualization instead of using an endoscope. And
used eyeballs instead of a microscope.
That's
basically.
Right. Yeah. Well, he looked through kind of a magnifying pair of glasses. But it definitely wasn't an endoscope. And as a result, you know, the patient in that case actually passed away as a result of a complication from the procedure that he did. And the allegation was if he had used an endoscope instead of just looking through the magnifying glass, the outcome would have been different. And they, the other side brought forth an expert, I think I can say where he's from, Chicago, incredibly well-written, great CV, as you said earlier, you know, his curriculum vitae outlined all of his training and his experience, and he had written a ton, and he was mean and tough. And I mean, I remember taking his deposition and thinking, I got nothing on this guy. Like, I have no idea how we're going to pull this out. Not to mention that my client looked like he was 90 years old and he had bad, bad cataracts. And it was almost like his eyes were cloudy. So I've got a whole case where my doctor is being accused of not seeing something very well.
Oh, God.
He looks like he can't see very well. And I've got this rock star of an expert that they brought in from Chicago against me. And I was terrified of that case, even though I really felt like my client had met the standard of care. And we had a good defense. It was still, you've got to evaluate your cases, not just based upon whether or not you think what your client did was right, but
is a jury
going to think that they did it right? I mean, that's, it's not just our opinion. It's what's going to be the opinion of the 12 that are going to make the decision. So we went into that case, and I mean, I was dreading the day when I was going to have to cross-examine that guy because I could not think of a way to hit him and take away his credibility.
No questions is not going to work.
No. When they present an expert, you can't say, I have no questions
right,
of this witness,
right,
Your
right.
Honor.
It's like they may as well just drop the mic on you right then.
That's right. And I think it was the Sunday before he was set to testify on Monday. And I was reading through everything that he had written about endoscopic procedures. And I'm reading, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, this guy is so good. Like, how am I going to get him? And then I notice at the end of each scientific journal article that he has written in a peer-reviewed journal, that there is a statement in there of disclosure that he has to make because he serves on the scientific advisory board of a number of endoscopic companies that manufacture the product that he's saying my client should have used in this case.
So it's like, so the whole case was like an advertisement for the company that he's getting paid by.
Essentially, yes.
Oh, wow.
And so I, he also happened to be a professor at a medical school. So then I went from the scientific journal articles that he had, I went to the university's website to see if they had to put something on their website about their affiliations with different companies. And in fact, they had an ethics statement from the university about their physician instructors and that they have to disclose that all of their affiliations with any companies that give them money that they sit on the scientific advisory boards for. So I printed out that page from the university's website.
So basically what you're saying is, so he's accusing your doctor of malpractice for not using a scope. The scope he's saying that should have been used is a scope that he endorses and gets paid for.
Yes.
And his university also endorses and gets paid for. And they have put all of these disclaimers on everything he's written saying, hey, we might have a conflict of interest
here.
Basically, because we get money from this company. Yes. Okay, I gotcha.
And then I called you and said, holy shit, Trisha, I think I got him. Which is exactly what I said. And we talked about it and you're like, you've got to set him up. You start with that. Start with that and literally start and say, how long have you been here today, doctor? How many hours have you been sitting on that witness stand testifying?
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Because that's not something I would have done.
Keep going.
Like, I'm the clinical one, right? So you're the creative one. You came up with that idea. And so I did. I started with that. Doctor, how long have you been here today? We started court this morning at 9:30. What time did you get on the witness stand? So how many hours do you think you've been up there? How many hours do you think you've spent testifying? And he you know, is like trying to do the math in his head and is like, where the hell is she going with this, right?
Right.
And I'll never forget the trial judge in the case. And I think I can, Judge Kincaid, who's retired now.
Yes, he's retired now.
Who I have always been a fan of. Yeah. But it's all of a sudden he sits up in his chair because he knows something's coming. Like, he's been a trial judge long enough, right, that you see
something's
the judge sit
down.
Up and
she's
I was like,
somewhere.
I got him.
Yeah.
Like, if I got him, I got the room, right?
Yeah, right.
And I said, so when were you planning to make your ethics disclosure to this jury? And he said, he kind of looked at me. The other side is out of their chair objecting.
Oh, of course, because they still don't know where you're going.
Right. And the judge looks at me. He goes, do you have a point? And I said, I have a point, Your Honor.
Oh, yes, I have a point.
And he goes, I'm going to give her a little latitude here, gentlemen. Ms. Lincoln, go ahead. And so I walked up to him with the first journal article that I had that he'd written, you know, 20 years earlier. For the end about endoscopes that had the disclosure on it. And I went through, I don't know, maybe three or four of those articles. And then I said, but not only that, but your university requires you to make these disclosures. In fact, it's an ethics statement by your university that requires you to make that statement. So when was it that you were going to tell these ladies and gentlemen of the jury that you have a conflict of interest in this case?
Oh, wow. See, that just destroys him, right? It's all about credibility.
Destroyed him.
And, you know, even substantively, if all of his comments and his, you know, expertise shown through, in 5 minutes, it's gone.
Yeah. Yeah. And I will tell you, the lawyers on the other side, not me, he sent a letter to my doctor. And
wow.
He apologized. He sent a letter to my doctor after that trial apologizing for not having that perspective before he came to court and testified. And we won that case. I'm not sure he would have apologized if we lost it. I don't know. Maybe he still would have. But yeah, I still have that letter. I must save that letter forever.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you.
But, you know, you can find things that are not a direct line of attack.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Like, that didn't go to his – it didn't go to what he had said explicitly. It didn't go to his – qualifications necessarily. He wasn't unqualified. In fact, he was overqualified.
He was biased, though, and that was the problem.
Yes.
And he didn't tell anybody.
Yes. And then, you know, and that's great, and that was good, and it was a lot of fun. But there, you know, there were some other things, too, that followed that line of cross. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we, that an old mentor of ours taught us, that was, you know, you ask a question if you don't get the answer that you want from an expert, you got to be ready to hit them over the head with a newspaper, right? So the more
training
times,
the witness,
the more times you hit them over the head with the newspaper, the more they're going to come into line and just start agreeing with you, right?
Your mother is a one horn flapper for people here. Yes.
That guy, after that line, he shut up. Like, I could ask him anything, and he was going to agree with me. So, I mean, that's another lesson is with a really tough witness, if you can hit them up front with something that they're really not expecting, you're going to make the rest of your examination of them that much easier. So, but that was a tough one, and it was a tough one for everybody. And again, you know, we started off in those district court cases that were 1 or 2 days, and you know, the wreck and neck cases, as we used to call them, for $2,000 a piece. We're not in that world anymore. I mean, what we're dealing with now is, you know, millions and millions of dollars and some pretty tough issues with some pretty sympathetic people on the other side.
Professional credibility. They're, you know, our clients, the doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals we represent, I mean, their credibility hangs on the line too. So
they care.
You know, of course they do. And we care for them as well. You know, that's part of doing a good job. Yeah. So I have a story to tell on the credibility thing now that we've kind of gone off on that, because what we're talking about really is that the tough cases we've had, a lot of them come down to credibility, right? Mm-hmm. Really, they do. And not only yours as the lawyer, but your clients and the witnesses. And I will tell you, I had one where I was representing a hospitalist, and the plaintiff's expert was an internist. Now, the difference is internal medicine is kind of like your family practice, your PCP, whatever.
Primary care
hospitalists
physician.
Hospitalists are pretty much internists, right? Oh, thank you, primary care physician. Hospitalists are the same thing, only they work exclusively in the hospital. Like, so it used to be that your primary care doctor would come to the hospital. Now it's the hospitalist. Anyway, there's a slight difference in the two practices. One's in the hospital and the other's out of the hospital. So there was a witness that was testifying who was an internist. I had the hospitalist. And I needed to find a way, because this guy was super credible. He was a professor.
Good witness.
He was a big deal. Mm-hmm. He was a great witness and just super likable and just very charismatic. And he was smooth and the jury was eating him up. And I needed to find a way, same thing as you, like what am I going to do with this person? And so much of it is that eureka moment or stumbling into a creative moment where you realize something. And so what I did was similar to what you're talking about. I went on the website for where he teaches, where he's a professor, and it's a medical school. And it just so happened there was a job position open to be an assistant professor of hospital medicine. And in order to qualify at his institution to even apply for a job as an assistant professor in hospital medicine, you had to have had at least 3 years working exclusively in the hospital, right?
Which he had not done.
So how beautiful was that, right? He was an internist outpatient and did very little in the hospital. So it turns out he couldn't even qualify at his own institution for an assistant professor position as a hospitalist, yet here he was, flew all the way to where we were, you know, in the courtroom, testifying against my hospitalist.
So basically, he couldn't even do what your guy did.
Done. Yeah. Wash your hands. You're done. Yeah. He couldn't even do it at your own school. So, you know, it's amazing, I guess, that don't stretch, right? Whether you're the plaintiff's lawyer, whether you're the expert, whether you're the defense lawyer, you don't stretch, because when you stretch, sometimes you break, you know?
Yeah, or somebody chops off your hand.
Or somebody, Or somebody really gets
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, we talk about that all the time, that it, particularly on cross-examination, as a lawyer maintaining your credibility, you have got to be able to get that shot off cleanly.
Yeah.
You got to think of every possible way they're going to answer that question and how you're going to respond to it to hit them over the head with the newspaper. I mean, like, every single step has to be controlled.
And how do you learn
controlled.
That? How have you learned that?
Practice, 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 and preparation, preparation, preparation. Watching other people do it. We have, you know, because of the type of practice that we have, we very frequently are in the courtroom with a co-defendant trying cases. And I have learned a ton from watching other lawyers cross-examine witnesses who don't exercise that level of control. Mm-hmm. you don't have, you don't have to attack every opinion that an expert has. You don't have to attack every statement that a witness has made if they're just a fact witness. You have got to pick something that you can go in and you can hit to destroy their credibility and get out. There's, you know, dragging it out doesn't make it better. It does not always make it better. You definitely need to keep it as clean as possible. I'm also kind of a control freak, so that helps.
Oh, really? I would have never guessed.
Maybe just a little bit.
Well, you know, it's we teach our young lawyers, and you have done this in seminars, and we teach our young lawyers the three questions, right? When you're putting a case together or you're preparing a cross-examination or whatever it is, what am I doing, right? Why am I doing it? And what are the consequences? I teach my kids this, right? What am I doing? I'm hitting my sister. Why are you doing it? Because it's fun. What are the consequences? I'm taking your phone. You know, I mean, and so whenever there's a method or a line of cross-examination you want to go after, you really need to, and that goes to your point of you don't just go after everything. What am I doing? Okay, I'm going to impeach this witness. Why am I doing it? And what are the consequences? What is, that's the third part of what you're talking about. What are the possible outcomes where my line of cross ends up blowing up in my face and I'm the one that looks to be not credible, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think those three questions I try to ask myself to this day, even when I'm doing pleadings or whatever, you know, what's the point of this? Mm-hmm. Am I doing it because it's rote? Am I doing it because everybody else does it? Am I objecting because that's just what comes naturally? Or is there a purposeful, thoughtful, strategic meaning to where I'm going with this? And I think what you did with that witness is getting in, making it clean, you get out, right? Only mm-hmm. three questions, really only three points that you need to make with really any witness so that you're not risking and you're not overselling.
Yeah, and I think that the tendency for a lot of lawyers, particularly on cross-examination, is – you know, I think one of the things that you learn in law school is cross-examination is, you know, it's supposed to be the method to get to the truth, but it's also supposed to be used if you're, you know, if you're paying attention to the old cross-examination literature, is that you need to tell your story through your questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't even ask a question at all. You're just making statements.
Right. Is you're really not. But so many lawyers do that. And, you know, you're not making the point. And particularly one of the things you really need to be doing, if that's your style, is watching the jury. Because there are so many times where the jury's like, all right, already, I've had enough. They're rolling their eyes at you. They're getting tired of listening to the lawyer's voice. You've made whatever point you can make.
They're
you've probably
you.
Already made, and they're done, and you need to move on. And that's particularly true from the defense side and in the types of cases that we're trying these days where, you know, we may be cross-examining a plaintiff's expert at the end of the second week of a trial, you know,
or and the so, 12th.
Well, yeah, that too. So, I mean, the jury's been there a long time. They're all missing their time from work. They're missing their time away from their families. They're, you know, this was not how they had planned on spending these weeks, and you're now wasting their time, and they get aggravated. And again, it comes back to credibility, right? And whether they like you or not weighs into whether or not they find you to be credible.
Whether or not they think it or not, right?
Right. Implicit, yeah.
Unintentional bias, whatever.
Absolutely,
you want to
call it. Absolutely. So yeah. It's just so important to pay attention even to those little details as you're presenting your case and presenting your cross-examination of a witness or even the direct.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, because we're talking about the toughest cases, you had in 1 year, I think you tried four cases, but two of them were baby cases.
Two bad baby
and
cases.
What I wanted to ask you is, does the injury of a child make it a harder case for you personally when a child's involved in one of the cases?
So I guess, you know, for a little bit of background, Trish and I are both moms. I have two daughters. Trish has a son and a daughter. My kids are now grown. They're at least one of them is in college and one of them has graduated from college. And, you know, I think injury to anybody is tough. I think, you know, wrongful death cases are real hard.
Yeah. Hard on the family.
You know, the really severely injured people who, you know, no longer can care for themselves. Those are hard. They're all hard, really. child injury cases are particularly difficult, not just because we're moms, but because
we're people,
right?
and we have hearts.
And we realize that our jurors are going to have some of those same feelings that we have. So trying to figure out when you already have that emotion yourself,
right,
but to feel badly for that mom and that child, it's really difficult to try and figure out how can we present this to a jury in a way that's going to make them not make their decision based upon emotion.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, our standard jury instruction in North Carolina is you are not to render your verdict based upon sympathy, pity, or partiality for either party. That's a direct quote out of our concluding jury instructions in North Carolina. So we have to talk to jurors about that a lot, that, you know, we all feel badly.
Right.
And we acknowledge that. I think that's one of the things that makes you and I somewhat authentic in the courtroom compared to some of our colleagues, is that we'll say, you know, everybody feels badly about them. Yeah. I remember the one case that I had where it was a delayed diagnosis of cancer case, and the woman passed away before the trial. Her husband had been appointed as the administrator of her estate. We took his deposition very early in the case and put him on video because he had been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. Oh, wow. And was probably not going to live until the trial. And he had the bluest eyes I'd ever seen in my whole life. And I just thought, oh, dear God, this is going to be bad. Like, it's just going to be so hard for the jury not to feel badly for these people, because then the daughter comes in and she's now the appointed administratrix of the estate, right? She's now lost both parents. And he was the sweetest man. And we just have to talk to jurors about it before you get started. You know, you have to tell them.
Well, you have to remember, though, and this is, you know, we're sometimes we feel like we're the bad guys because we're, you know, preventing an injured person from receiving compensation. And when I talk to people, lay people, friends, family, you know, about what I do, a lot of times it's like there's an automatic assumption that the doctor or the healthcare provider did something wrong because we have these horrible injuries. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I tell people all the time, you know, if you look at the back of an aspirin bottle, there is a disclaimer on there that says risk of death, right? Mm-hmm. Do you take the aspirin anyway? Of course you do, but it may be a 0.001% chance, but if you're the one who dies, it's 100% for you, right? So, I mean, I think the part of what we take into the courtroom is a very realistic view of the informed consent documents are signed for a reason. You have to look at the risks and benefits of everything, and medicine is not an exact science. It's an art, very much, as much mm-hmm. as it is science. And judgment and gestalt and, you know, experience, all the things that we're talking about that we have, they have too. And they make the best decisions that they can, but it doesn't ensure that you're going to have a perfect outcome. I think a lot of the time, the jury, when you first get them, the belief is that if anything happens in the doctor's hands, it clearly is her fault. And, you know, through education and through careful telling of the story and the jury instructions and vetting the jurors and voir dire when you're picking a jury, I think through that you can kind of help them understand that a bad outcome can happen in the very best of hands. We can have a bad result in a case, even though we've done everything right, right?
Right.
I mean, that can happen.
Hey, there's a winner and loser in every single one of our cases.
And does that
it doesn't mean that the other side was negligent,
right? That's right. And so, you know, I think there has to be an understanding of that. But the sympathy factor, especially with the kids, I think is really hard to get past. It's a tough. I mean, I've teared up before seeing a minor child come into the courtroom who's been injured, and, you know, it's a human response. It doesn't mean that we don't care. It means that what we're doing is upholding the law and helping the jury understand that bad things happen to good people and outcomes can be bad despite the very most best hands and experienced teams. So
it's still terrifying when you've got 4 or 5 jurors in the box crying during your trial.
Oh, yeah.
Over the sympathetic plaintiff who's sitting there, you know, I mean, it is.
I've seen twelve cry.
You can still come back
and still come back and still
win.
Defense,
yeah,
because they can understand that at some point they have to separate themselves from the feel emotion and the law. So,
well, they don't just understand that. We've helped them to understand that. I mean, that's got to be part of the process.
Our job, yes,
Yeah. Yes, yes. And the lawyers who ignore that, the lawyers who are afraid of that, the lawyers who are defending doctors and in jury selection don't ask the question, how many of you have had a bad experience with a healthcare provider?
Because all 12 of them are raising their hands.
I mean, goodness sake, yes. Ask the question. You need to know these things, right?
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
I think, again, that gives you that authenticity that you understand that there's going to be. I mean, heck, I raise my hand. I've had bad experiences with healthcare providers for sure. I still defend them.
Good. That's pretty good.
Right?
Do you do that in Fort Deer?
Heck yeah, I
like
do.
That. That's pretty cool.
Nobody's objected yet. Huh. Now they will.
So the takeaways. Credibility, I think, is what we've been talking about.
Here. Yeah.
That's really tough. Tough cases are tough because either there's been a credibility issue either against us or in our favor. And
yeah, and sometimes you can't defend against them. That's my other really tough story is my case with the physician who died during our first trial. Yeah. So I had a case, Scott Addison in our office and I were trying it. It was a hard case, very high profile plaintiff. He was an athlete and our doctor who was a surgeon. And the Monday of the second week of the trial, we were getting ready to do opening statements and we got the call at the courthouse that he'd been found dead that morning. And he was on his way to court.
I remember that phone call.
Oh, that was a hard phone call. I think we in particular have a reputation for being pretty hard. I think most people don't appreciate that we actually are emotional to some extent. We hide that most of the time pretty well. I mean, but we have our moments, and that was a moment. I'm not going to lie.
No,
one of the few
horrible.
Times I've cried in the courtroom. And so, of course, they had to declare a mistrial immediately. I mean, we had no idea how to even begin to manage that at that point. And we ended up a year later having to try that case without him. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm not sure which, they had put his deposition on video. And so we did have his videotape testimony where the plaintiff had done all the questioning because we don't usually right. ask our doctors a lot of questions right. following the plaintiff's examination of them at a deposition unless there's something that we really feel like we need to clarify, correct.
You didn't have a crystal ball to know he wasn't going to be there at trial,
no,
right?
No, I definitely did not, or I would have made him go to the hospital the day before he died. In any event, so what was crazy is, and we talked about this a little bit earlier today, is, you know, the case that you start with is not necessarily the case that you end up trying. And what these lawyers did, frankly, was brilliant. And they completely changed their theory of the case. And they changed their theory of the case to an informed consent theory. And I think I can disclose that the issue was that this athlete had been returned to play at a very high level sport
too early.
And they changed the entire theory of their case to you did not get the player's informed consent to return to play that early. You didn't explain to him all the risks and possibilities.
Yeah, because they don't sign informed consents for return to works.
Correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And that had not been their theory when they took my client's deposition.
So he couldn't.
That had not been their theory when we started the trial the last time. And that was the theory that we were now faced with no ability to defend against it because my client had never been asked the question. What conversations had they had about going back to play?
And there's nothing you can do about that.
Nothing. And they surely do not teach you how to deal with that
in
law school.
Like, oh, good God, no.
or in practice. I mean, it's happened to very few people. I had one other lawyer that we know here in North Carolina who had had that happen during a trial, and he did call me afterwards and was like, there's nobody who wants to be in this club at all.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a fun place to be, but you know, sometimes there's just nothing you can do with that void that you have, but you've still got to find a way to try and defend the case as best as you can. And we still did, you know, and we didn't win that case. We did not get an outright defense verdict in that case. But
it was definitely mitigated.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they asked for well into the seven figures and they did not get a seven figure verdict. So for them, they didn't feel like they'd won. I felt like I had just been destroyed, that I hadn't upheld.
Because you always get zeros.
Yeah, well, that and I felt like it was his reputation, his lifelong reputation that was now kind of in my hands, you know, and we didn't get that.
Okay. So, you know, again, the takeaways that from this are credibility is key.
Yeah.
You can't control everything.
That's right.
You know, sometimes mm-hmm. you have to work with what you have, and it may be your witness that got made on the witness stand. And, you know, you ask the questions and you try to issue spot those things in advance to prevent them from happening. But even, you know, just like the doctors that we represent, even in the very best hands, you can have situations that you just can't control. You mm-hmm. can't fix and you can't manipulate. So,
yeah,
I don't know. I think that's kind of the takeaway for tough cases. Yeah.
They make us better.
They do. They do. They put hair on your chest. Actually, we don't want that. Never mind. No. They make you better, but they make you stronger. So the verdict, we're at the end. Please download us, rate us, give us feedback, ask questions. We don't know what you want to hear unless you tell us. So,
oh, that's a great idea. Yeah, please. That would be great.
They can email us. We can put our email in the show notes, right? They can email us and ask questions. And
maybe we'll
can do
them.
Like a FAQ.
Yeah.
That'd be fun.
I think that's a great idea.
Awesome.